I want to go back to a doctrine of the church today. It's been a while. We cover one of the fundamental beliefs, one of the hallmarks of the Church of God from the time you came into contact with it has been the fact that they will give you magazines, booklets. They will, well, once upon a time, put out a daily radio broadcast. Today it's a telecast or webcast. There is a phenomenal internet presence. And there are local congregations, like our seal speaks of, preaching the gospel and preparing a people. There are all kinds of things that are provided for us. And somewhere in each issue of Beyond Today, there'll be a little box and it'll explain how your subscription is paid for. And that takes us to the topic of tithing. And looking back through my notes, it's not a topic that I remember discussing here. So once in a while we have the question, is tithing the way United practices it the way it was commanded and followed in the Bible? Let me first go to the fundamental belief statement. If you have the booklet or if you go online and find the listing of them, here is the actual statement. We believe in tithing as a way of honoring God with our substance. So we'll pause right there. We give to God what is already God's. Everything is God's. Whatever we are blessed with, whatever our increase is, God asks that we give a tenth of it back. The old English word tithe just simply means tenth. So he asks that we give a tenth back. Now, I'm not going to go into the other aspects of the tithing law that govern the second tithe. That's our term. First, second, third tithes, those are our terms. If anybody here did not know about third tithe, my apologies for just dropping it on you, but you need to know. But the way that the third tithe was administered in ancient Israel, there were 7-year cycles, and on year 3 and year 6 of that cycle, the Israelites gave what's called, oftentimes your commentaries will call it a poor tithe, for the poor, the needy, the orphans, etc. Tithing is a way of worshiping God, of giving God what is His. It's an act of faith that by giving we believe that we will be better off with 90% and God's blessing than we would have been with the 100%. Well, let me continue with the statement. And as a means of serving Him in the preaching of the gospel, the care of the church, attending the festivals, and helping the needy. There are a number of scriptures stated with that belief statement, but we'll be turning to those in the course of the sermon. Those of you who remember the ministry of Herbert Armstrong, and I have to phrase it that way, the man's been in his grave 31 and a half years. And in reality, anyone mid-30s and younger has no direct memory of them. Our youngest son was not born by the time he died, or no, he was born months after he died. Our older two are just old enough in their late 30s that they do have very distinct memories of him. But a lot of people have come to the church, and we talk about Herbert Armstrong this, Herbert Armstrong that, just like, you know, some in the 80s would hear about, well, Mrs. Loma Armstrong said this, and they're thinking, who is that? So we do have to look at it differently. But I think one of the greatest works left behind by Mr. Armstrong was his own autobiography. There's just so much that can be learned from the fact that he told his own story. This comes from Volume 1, page 412. And I'll just read a little bit here about how they addressed the issue of tithing. I had come to learn and understand one doctrine at a time. The truth was not acquired all at once. I had known that the Bible had quite a little to say about tithing one's income. Yet, somehow, it had never become completely clear to us. At about this time, in the little time I had for my work at the newspaper for Bible study and prayer, I had made a special and thorough study of this matter of tithing. We saw the mistake we had been making and started a definite practice of strict tithing. We only had a very little on hand, but we sent a tenth of it, plus an offering, to the Oregon Conference treasurer of the Church of God Seventh-day. That very day, the way opened for us to be able to stock up at home with a reasonable abundance of food. For one thing, we had a large, thick steak. My wife cooked it at low heat with the utensils we had acquired when I devoted a year to selling them. I shall never forget that steak. It was way and by far the best steak I've ever tasted. Like from the quote that Theodore Roosevelt used that phrase, way and by far, or something close to that. It must have been a phrase from the earlier part of the 1900s. Continuing, although we still were required to live another 14 years in the barest and most modest financial circumstances, we have never from that day had to be actually hungry and miss meals because of financial poverty. We have since heard scores and scores of case histories of the experience of others who were immediately prospered once they began tithing. But we ourselves lived through the same experience. And he said that my wife and I had to learn it the hard way. Well, they were not hungry from the time they began tithing. And some of you may remember the first time you tithed. I sent in my tithes when I was fairly young and was happy to do so. It was new. It was exciting. And I'm sure that God forgave me of the fact that the tithe was on some pigs that I had sold. He blessed us with greater knowledge to give the pigs a get off the farm order. I want to read a little bit. You know, sometimes a question comes up, a statement is made, you know, how can I tithe with all this oppressive taxation? A book that I read a long time ago, and I made a copy of one particular chapter that has to do with government and taxation. This is an economic background of the Gospels written by Frederick Grant. And he's looking at the tithing and taxation load on the Jews, or we could say Christians, in the first century when Christ was here. And so he says we shall consider the taxation, the secular tribute and the religious dues. And most of this chapter I'm going to skip over, but let me go over to page 101. He says, oppressive taxation has been the fate of the East throughout history. It has in some regions almost completely crushed and annihilated enterprise and initiative. The burden was steadily growing greater in first century Palestine. The question of the tribute, and he uses the word tribute, that was generally what was used then, I mean to describe events then, but we would call it taxes. The tribute was a burning issue for the hearers of our Lord. In the Gospels, we have once in a while someone who is a publican, if you have the old King James, or a tax collector. And they were among some of the more hated people of society. They were Jews working for Rome to take taxes from Jews to give to Rome. They were notorious for siphoning off enough to make life comfortable for them. Continuing, Grant writes, the scribes, in asking him whether it was lawful or not to pay the tax to Caesar, were handing him a live bomb. His dexterity in returning it proves him just as keenly practical in mind as he was idealistic and spiritual. Jesus said, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are his. There's no use, he said, to try to avoid payment. God's requirements may be met at the same time. It is not a contradiction in terms to pay tribute to both. He says then, taxes were exorbitant. Let me go back to a listing that he provides. There's a listing on pages 94 and 95. The taxation at the time. Now, these are the religious taxes only. Taxes or tribute, he's using that term, but tithing, we would call it, along with other offerings. So, the religious obligations of the faithful Israelite at that time, first of all, you had the sin offering, thank offering, and showbread. These were old obligations going back a long time. You had the first fruits of grain, grapes, figs, pomegranates, olives, and honey. You had the best of the fruits of the field and of the trees. You had the tithe, the first tithe is the one that is sacred to God. In the Old Covenant days, they would give it to the local Levite. The local Levites then would give a tenth of that, or a tithe of the tithe that went to the priests. The priests were the line of Aaron within the line of Levi. So he had the tithe, and then he said in addition, this was the second tithe, described in books of Numbers, Deuteronomy. That was the feast tithe, not holy to God, but to be kept and set aside for your purpose to go and keep the annual feasts. That's where in Deuteronomy it talks about you go to the place where God sets his name and you eat before him. Then there is firstborn of animals, redemption money for firstborn. So if there was an animal they wanted to keep, then they could give the value of that and add to that 20%, one-fifth. Okay, and all this comes together. Page 105, he says, the total taxation of the Jewish people in the time of Jesus, civil and religious combined, must have approached the intolerable proportion of between 30 and 40%. And it may have been higher still. But, you know, if you look at the tithing, a little earlier he said that the taxation was above 30. If you add the first tithe that went to the local Levite, the second tithe that you kept so you and your family can keep the feast, if you look at 2 years and seven, you're going to have a third tithe for the poor and the needy among you, and you add it all up, you're more like in the 50 to 60% range. Enough of Grant. That's discouraging. But then again, that's kind of what we're living, isn't it? The question of how can I tithe when I am so heavily taxed by my country is as old as the hills, or at least as old as the days of Christ. Again, many of us remember the presidency of Ronald Reagan, and during his time in office in the 1980s, at one point, he made reference to the fact how the good Lord had a pretty good system. Just whatever you make, pay 10%. And then he said the problem we run into is when we seek to figure Caesar's part. That's the challenge. Caesar wants more. Caesar meaning the federal government. We have a lot of people in this country who want more and more services, and that costs, and we have problems. Now, over 25 years ago, there was an assault upon the church and our doctrines, and one assault was on the practice of teaching. There were those who called us an Old Covenant church, which is ludicrous, and they said that we were under bondage to a three-tithe system, which is, well, today we'd call that fake news. It's skewing the news, because we only gave one tithe to God. The second one was for a holy purpose, but it was not holy to God. We kept it. We set it aside to fund our keeping of the feast. And then it was only in a third and a sixth year of a seven-year cycle, or I forget, some used to pay a certain amount every year. Now, years ago, early on United, that topic was looked at, and that's left as an individual situation. And I'm getting off on second and third tithe here in a way that I didn't intend to. But some of you are in situations helping family members and you give a lot. And we know all about that. And there are others who financially subsidize family members who are needy. And there are others who receive help and certainly are not in a position of helping the needy. But then there are those who can and do not have family obligations, and so they're able to help with the church's assistance fund. So I want to make a survey of tithing in the Bible. We won't go to every last verse. I didn't finish my thought there on those that assaulted tithing. There were those who said we were trying to earn salvation by tithing, which is laughable. There were those who said it was involuntary. And I've never had anyone hold a knife to my back, or worse, threaten me with a baseball bat if I didn't sign that check and send it in. And that it was mandatory for membership. Well, I can speak for 37 years of being out and hearing people's stories. and somebody new, and they're trying to look at it on paper. You know, a lot of times on paper, your budget with tithing, it will not work. But it is fascinating to step out in faith and put God first and do it. And lo and behold, the 90% with God's blessing, you're better off than you would have been otherwise. So there have been a lot of times when people have said, well, you know, I'm sorry, I spent some of my second tithe. And I've said, don't do that again. Well, I'm summarizing the story here. But I've never known of anyone put out of the church because they aren't tithing. But they ought to be tithing. Okay, let's go on then with our survey. It won't be exhaustive, but we find tithing in the book of Genesis. Tithing predated the Old Covenant by centuries. Let's go to Genesis 14, the days of Abraham, or Abram, as he is still called, Abram, as he's still called at this time. This chapter tells the story of the Battle of the Kings. You have the alliance of a number of kings from up in Mesopotamia, and they came down against an alliance of kings down in the valley, down south of the Dead Sea, Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, Zeboam, etc., Zoar. Of course, those from Mesopotamia won. They carted off a lot of property, a lot of people. And you remember the story how Abraham heard of it. Lot was caught up with that, taken captive, and how Abraham got his trained servants, went out after them, and pursued them to Dan, verse 14. But let's skip on down a little further. He essentially won, got all of the goods and the people, and brought them back. Verse 17, the king of Sodom. That was one of the five kings allied down in their area. The king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of Chedorlaomer, and of the kings that were with him in the valley of Sheba, which is the king's dale. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. Now, people debate who is this Melchizedek, and the book of Hebrews, as we'll look at a little later, makes it pretty clear. This was the pre-incarnate Christ. The dots are connected in Hebrews. He was without father, without mother, no beginning of days. So this is the pre-incarnate Christ appearing as this priest of the Most High. And to this day, he is a priest. And we have reverted back to the earlier priesthood of Melchizedek. And the priesthood through the Levites has come and had its time and is basically placed on the back burner. It's basically obsolete, although at the time of the end, there'll be sacrifices again. And for a little while, at least, at the beginning of the millennium, there'll be a return of sacrifices, probably to use the best of both worlds, that for a carnally minded people to have physical sacrifices for a while to get them in the habit of obedience. Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he, that's Melchizedek, blessed him, Abraham, and said, blessed be Abram of the Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. So the Most High God, we see here, he is the one who owns everything. And blessed be the Most High God, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he, that's Abram, gave him, Melchizedek, tithes of all. So everything that he had gathered, all of the wealth, the goods, everything he brought back, he gave a tithe to Melchizedek. The king of Sodom said unto Abram, give me the persons and take the goods to yourself. And Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lift up my hand unto the Lord, the Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread, even to a shoe latchet. I'm reading the King James, by the way, today. And that I will not take anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich, save only that which the young men have eaten, because you don't muzzle the ox that treads the grain. And the portion which went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, let them take their portion. So some who went to help him, they take back their own portion that had been taken away. So, interesting section here, this Melchizedek, priest of God, priest of the Most High. Josephus, and again, Josephus was a historian. He had his bias, writing in the first century. He was a Jewish general. He was taken captive, and then he kind of was working on the side of the Roman generals. Vespasian first, and then Titus. He was there with the Roman legions, calling across to his own countrymen in Jerusalem to give themselves up, and it'll go easier on them. And then he wrote the Wars of the Jews, he wrote at the behest of the Emperor Vespasian. And so he does have a slant, but it would be interesting to know what kind of histories had been passed on. But he mentions that with this event, that this Melchizedek was building a place called Salem, and let's not necessarily jump to the conclusion that was Jerusalem. It may have been, but we really aren't given enough information. And that he was building a place for the righteous to have a point of access to God. But the Bible doesn't tell us, but it's just curious. So we look at this, and the context is one of God owning everything, of God giving Abraham the victory, of Abraham or Abram having all the spoils. He was free to do with it as he willed, and he willed, he was pleased to give a tithe to this priest of the Most High. Abraham's action was voluntary. It was not coerced in any way. It was not mandatory. There's no concept of law yet. And he tithed on all. So tithing here is, again, a matter of faith and trusting that you will be better off with the 90% plus God's blessing than you would have been with the 100%. Let's go to Leviticus 27. In the intervening centuries, Israel has gone to Egypt, and then they've been brought out. They have come to Sinai, entered a covenant with God. They promise God, all you command we will do. And so then God begins to give them certain instructions. 10 commandments, statutes, a national covenant was entered into. It was ratified by blood. The plan for building the tabernacle was given. Then we get to Leviticus, and from the Septuagint, or from the Greek Septuagint name, it means pertaining to the Levites. Instructed the Levites on what they were to do whenever someone came with a burnt offering, grain offering, peace, scent, trespass, various types of offerings. And the setting aside of Aaron and sons and so on and so forth. But here in chapter 27, they haven't even come to the Holy Land yet. They haven't come to Canaan. That takes place in Numbers. Numbers 14, they go. Spies are sent in, 13 and 14 actually. Spies go in, they believe the evil report, and it led to 40 years in the wilderness and the older generation is dying. But in Leviticus 27, notice verse 30. In all the tithe of the land. Now again, tithe is the old English. It just simply means tenth. Whether of the seed of the land or the fruit of the tree is the Lord's, it is holy unto the Lord. Now that last phrase, when the feast tithe is spoken of, it is never called as something that is holy unto the Lord. Now, it is for a holy purpose only, but it's not something sanctified and to be given to God. It's something you keep to go keep the holy days. And if a man will at all redeem any of his tithes, he shall add thereunto the fifth part thereof. Now, again, think agrarian society. Maybe a part of that was some exceptionally fine quality seed, and he wanted to keep it for planting the next year, and he could do that by the monetary value plus 20%. Maybe it was a firstling that he wanted to keep. Verse 32, and concerning the tithe of the herd or of the flock, even of whatsoever passes under the rod, the tenth shall be holy unto the Lord. Now, keep your place back here in the Pentateuch. Let's go to Psalm 24, a statement that underscores the fact that everything already is God's. We are stewards only of what God allows us to have and to use during the time that we live on this earth. Psalm 24, verse 1. The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell in there. For he founded it upon the seas and established it upon the floods. So everything is God's already. The earth and everything in it, and all people who dwell therein. Let's go back to Exodus 19, when they were entering that covenant with God. Exodus 19 and reading verse 5. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then you shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine, God says. Now, we have a booklet. What does the Bible teach about tithing? If you haven't read it in some time, it would be good to go back and do so. But in writing about some of these scriptures we've already looked at, this is on page 3, after it had discussed the example of Abraham in Genesis 14. This example shows several important principles we can apply today. Abraham, whose exemplary life of service and obedience to God caused God to describe him as the father of the faithful, was not compelled, meaning coerced, forced to tithe. He gave willingly and voluntarily as an act of great humility. He showed respect and reverence for God and to Melchizedek, who was both king of Salem and priest of the Most High. Jesus Christ serves in this royal and priestly office today, and to tithe is to show him appropriate honor. This example also demonstrates Abraham's enormous personal integrity and character. He chose to keep his promise to God rather than give in to the temptation to use the spoils of his victory for himself. Abraham understood the premise for giving a tithe to God. God is the possessor of heaven and earth. Abraham recognized that he was blessed by God Most High, who made his victory and all his human blessings possible. Let's go to Genesis again. Let's go to chapter 28. Two generations later, we go from Abraham to Isaac and then to Jacob. And we again find the word tithe or tithes used. In Genesis 28, we have the story of Jacob being sent back to his mother's people, back home to find a wife there from from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. He is making his trip. He lies down and has a dream, this ladder rising up to heaven, angels ascending and descending. So a little bit later, he's very religious. He got his attention in many ways. And let's look in beginning verse 20. Genesis 28, verse 20. And Jacob vowed a vow, saying, if God will be with me. And there's still a bit of Jacob here. He's still got some rough edges to be knocked off. But God, through his uncle Laban, is going to do a lot of good work on Jacob. And he's playing let's make a deal, somewhat. If God will be with me, and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat, and raiment to put on, so that I will come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. So if God gives me all this stuff, brings me on his way, then he'll be my God. And this stone, which I have set for a pillar, shall be God's house. And of all that you shall give me, I will surely give the tenth unto you. So Jacob promised God that he would give a tenth back to him from all which God gives first to him. Once again, there's no mention of a law yet. It becomes codified a bit later on. His action, like Abram's, was voluntary. It was an issue of faith, once again, in believing that he would be better off with the 90% with God's blessing than with the whole amount. So Israel goes to captivity, they are miraculously brought out, they enter their covenant, and later on we find tithing is incorporated into the covenant agreement. Let's go to Numbers 18. We won't go today to places in Deuteronomy, like Deuteronomy 12 and 14, that focus on the feast tithe and the poor tithe. Numbers 18, verse 20. And the Lord spoke unto Aaron, you shall have no inheritance in their land. So Aaron and his sons were to form the priesthood. They were all Levites. All Levites are not priests, but all priests were Levites. Neither shall you have any part among them. I am your part and your inheritance among the children of Israel. And behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tenth in Israel for an inheritance. Now, all of the other tribes. And that would be 12, because remember there was an inheritance given. The tribe of Joseph was cut in two. And you had Manasseh with an inheritance and Ephraim with an inheritance. And then the other 11. For their service which they serve, even the service of the tabernacle of the congregation. Neither must the children of Israel henceforth come near the tabernacle of the congregation, lest they sin and die. But the Levites shall do the service of the tabernacle of the congregation, and they shall bear their iniquity. It shall be a statute. So see, tithing falls among the statutes. Healing the statute, and holy days are called statutes. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations, that among the children of Israel they have no inheritance. Meaning they were given no land or territory to live upon. But the tithes of the children of Israel, which they offer as a heave offering, and again, think of an agrarian society, most of the tithes are going to be produce and grain, which they offer as a heave offering unto the Lord, I have given to the Levites to inherit. Therefore I have said unto them, among the children of Israel, they shall have no inheritance. And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, thus speak to the Levites, and say to them, when you take of the children of Israel the tithes. So you see, the wording here is more of a command. You are to take from the children of Israel their tithes, which I have given you from them for your inheritance. Then you shall offer up a heave offering of it for the Lord, even a tenth part of the tithe. And this your heave offering shall be reckoned to you as though it were the corn of the threshing floor and as the fullness of the winepress. Thus you shall offer a heave offering unto the Lord of all your tithes which you receive of the children of Israel, and you shall give thereof the Lord's heave offering to Aaron the priest. Now this is as far as we need to read. Basically, the Levites did not receive a land inheritance. They were to work the service of the tabernacle. So that they would be able to do that without running livestock, without planting crops and produce, the Israelites would go and give a tenth of their increase to the Levite. The Levites would then take a tenth of that and give it specifically to the line of Aaron, the priesthood within the tribe. It is written and codified for them. We need to be careful to not take every minute detail as something that literally applies today, but there are principles and lessons learned from every word that is written. Let's see. International Standard Bible Encyclopedia on the word tithe. The custom of giving a tenth part of the products of the land and the spoils of war to priests and kings was a very ancient one among most nations. That the Jews had this custom long before the institution of the Mosaic Law is shown in Genesis 14 and 28. Many critics hold that these two passages were written late and only reflect the latter practice of the nation. But the payment of the tithes is so ancient and deeply rooted in the history of the human race that it seems simpler and more natural to believe that among the Jews the practice was in existence long before the time of Moses. You had a tithing law. Well, it became a law. You had tithing as a practice. Abraham did it. God told Isaac, his son, your father Abraham kept my law, my charge, my commandments, etc. Jacob came along, he tithed. It was around before. It was a part of, it was given to Melchizedek, at least in Abraham's case. Then you had the old covenant that came along. It was temporary. There is no holy place today. It was temporary. It lasted basically from 1400s down to the time of Christ. And there are no local Levites serving the tabernacle today. There is no holy place. There will be one at the time of the end. But there is no way. Again, we'll get to that in the book of Hebrews. It gives us a bit of the rest of the story. Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews, Book 4, Chapter 4, Paragraphs 3 and 4, writing about Moses. He appointed the people should pay the tithe of their annual fruits of the Lord, both to the Levites and to the priests. And actually, they gave it to the Levites took a tenth and gave it to the priesthood. Well, later he said, let there be taken out of your fruits a tenth besides that which you have allotted to give to the priests and Levites. And that's introducing the second tithe or festival tithe. Used to go to the place where God sets his name. Go to 1 Samuel 8. 1 Samuel 8 does not address tithing per se, but it gives us a bit of a forerunner of what became a pattern that follows down to this very day. Up until this event, God was king. God was leading Israel. God led Israel through some of the patriarchs. God later led them through Moses, Joshua, and different ones. Judges, you have God raising up a hero one place or another within where the tribes were settled. Now we're drawing to a time where the elders of Israel go to Samuel, the chief prophet and judge, and they say, we want to be like the world. Give us a king. And so this chapter tells us that man was warned, but it has become a pattern that we see playing out to this very day. Chapter 8, 1 Samuel, verse 4. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together, came to Samuel unto Ramah, and said to him, behold, you are old, and your sons walk not in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto the Lord. The Lord said to Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people, and all that they say unto you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. Well, down a little further, Samuel goes. God tells him, give them what they've asked for. But he warns them, this is what a king will do. Verse 11, and he said, this will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take of your sons and appoint them for himself. So he's going to conscript your sons for his military. For his chariots, to be his horsemen, and some to run before his chariots. He will appoint him captains over thousands and captains over fifties, and will set them to ear is the old King James for planting. He'll set them to plant his ground, the king's ground, and to reap his harvest, and to make his instruments of war, and instruments of his chariots. So very heavy on the word his. They're going to work for, their lives will be devoted to whatever the king orders. Verse 13, and he will take your daughters to be confectionaries and to be cooks and to be bakers. He will take your fields and your vineyards. How many times have people lost property or something is proclaimed as being in the eminent domain? And so a power line goes through, a freeway goes through. And the people that owned it for 150 years, there's not one thing that can be done about it, except get yourself arrested. He will take of your fields, your vineyards, your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. He'll take the tenth of your seed and your vineyards and give to his officers. Yeah, and we can go on. Verse 17, a tenth of your sheep. That's what they got. The king would take additional tax or tribute, and conscript children for military or service in other areas, and human government follows the same pattern. Well, the house of Israel fell, and they went into captivity. Go to Nehemiah chapter 13. A bit later, the house of Judah fell and went into captivity. But they were sent back, at least a portion, a remnant, sent back to Israel, or sent back to the land of Judah, to rebuild. And sometimes they worked hard and sometimes they didn't. You know, Joshua, Zerubbabel, Ezra, Nehemiah. Nehemiah was one who could really light a fire on the people. It was like he had a cattle prod, and you know, he even threatened them. If you don't do what I say, he smote certain ones of them. Nehemiah 13, verse 10. And I perceived that the portions of the Levites had not been given. And that has to refer to tithes. For the Levites and the singers that did the work were fled, everyone to his field. Well, originally, in Numbers 18, they were to be given the tithes so that they would not have to go work their own fields. They had their job, and that was the service of the tabernacle. Then contended I with the rulers and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together and set them in their place. Then brought all Judah the tithe of the corn and of the new wine and the oil into the treasuries. And I made treasurers over the treasuries. And lists a number of names, the end of verse 13, and their office was to distribute unto their brethren. Remember me, O my God, concerning this, and wipe not out all my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for the offices thereof. Well, let's back up to chapter 10. Nehemiah 10, verses 37 and 38. 10, verse 37. And that we should bring the first fruits of our dough and our offerings and the fruit of all manner of trees, of wine and of oil unto the priests, to the chambers of the house of our God. And the tithes of our ground unto the Levites, that the same Levites might have the tithe in all the cities of our tillage. And the priest, the son of Aaron, shall be with the Levites when the Levites take tithes, and the Levites shall bring up the tithe of the tithes into the house of our God, to the chambers, into the treasure house. So again, speaking of the fact that the Israelites would tithe to the Levites would take a tenth and give to the specifically the priestly line among them. Nehemiah 12, verse 44. And at that time were some appointed over the chambers for the treasures, for the offerings, for the first fruits, for the tithes, to gather into them out of the fields of the cities the portions of the law, for the priests and Levites, for Judah rejoiced for the priests and for the Levites that waited. And so he set things back on track. Restored at that time. How long it lasted, we aren't told. But you look back across the history of the work of God, and as far as tithing specifically, it's had its prosperous years and its lean years. Now let's go to the New Testament, Matthew 22, and beginning in verse 17. And this is where the story was referred to in something I read earlier. Tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar or not? So they were pulling the pin on the grenade and handing it to him. But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, why tempt you me, you hypocrites? Now, he had been tempted by the tempter himself, so anything that the religious leaders could throw at him, he would see through. Show me the tribute money. And they brought him a penny. And he said unto them, whose is this image and superscription? They say unto him, Caesar's. Then he said unto them, render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. Now it doesn't specifically say tithe, but it does in the next chapter. In Matthew 23, we have a number of places where he strongly corrects, reproves the scribes and the Pharisees. However, they sat in Moses' seat, he said in verse 2. And in verse 3, he said, do as they say, but don't do what they do. They live as hypocrites. They're living a lie. Chapter 23, let's skip on down through some of the woes, down to verse 23. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin. From anything I've ever read, these are some of the tiniest of seeds, and they had gone to the effort of very carefully, meticulously divided out a tenth of what they had. Instead of, if you have a bushel, just take something that looks like it's a tenth or a little more and give it to God. But they were very carefully separating God's part out and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. These ought you to have done. You see, a lot of times they saw the letter at the expense of the spiritual intent behind it. And that's what they were doing here. What was more important that they should be doing is the judgment, mercy, and faith. But above he spoke of tithing, and then he says, and not to leave the other undone. We can't conclude anything else but tithing. Do not leave the tithing undone. But a deeper focus was to be upon the weightier spiritual matters. And God help us to be able to see the things that are most important. Hebrews chapter 7. Hebrews is not signed, but generally thought to be the product of Paul. The way that it's written, the way he argues, it just smacks of Paul. The date generally given is in the first half of the 60s. It's before the Jewish revolt. It's certainly before the desolation of the temple, the destruction of the holy place. But it was written at a time to prepare the Jews for the fact that's going to happen soon. And it was so inflammatory to the Jewish leaders at that time, when this book came out, they were so incensed that they went and took James, and this would be James, the half-brother of Christ, the one that we read of in Acts 15 as being kind of the resident minister in charge, apostle. But they took James to the high point of the temple and they threw him off. And the fall did not fully kill him, so they finished the job down below. But in chapter 7, it's interesting that the author uses the priesthood and tithing to show that now under the new covenant there are some things that have changed, or that are changing, or are about to be changed. We had a transitionary era of time from the time of Christ's death, 31 AD, until 70 AD when the temple was destroyed and the holy place destroyed. You had about four decades. You could have a Jewish Christian who could have tithed to the local Levite, or he could have tithed to the local minister of the church. But it's moving toward the point where there won't be any functioning Levitical priesthood to give tithes to, and there's a change of a law, a change in application. So verse 1, for this Melchizedek, the word means king of righteousness, king of Salem. Salem, from the consonants there, same as in Shalom, peace. Priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. To whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all. First being by interpretation king of righteousness, and after that also king of Salem, which is king of peace. Without father, without mother. All right, we already see this is not any human being. Without descent, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like unto the Son of God, abides a priest continually. So here we have the dots begin to be connected. Now consider how great this man was, unto whom even the patriarch Abraham gave the tenth of the spoils. This man, this being, this person, was far greater than Abraham. And verily, they that are of the sons of Levi, who receive the office of the priesthood. So you have the tribe of Levi. Within that, you have the line of Aaron. Have a commandment. So it is a command. It became a law. It became a statute. To take tithes of the people according to the law. That is, of their brethren. Though they come out of the loins of Abraham. Everyone we're dealing with here is a descendant of Abraham. But he, whose descent is not counted from them, received tithes of Abraham and blessed him, and that had the promises. And without all contradiction, the less, that's Abraham, is blessed of the better, Melchizedek. And here on earth, men, in this case Levites, men that die receive tithes. But there he receives them of whom it is witnessed that he lives. No record that he ever died, just that little passing reference in Genesis, and then he's referred to in Psalms, and he's referred to in Hebrews, and that's about it. And as I may so say, Levi also, who received tithes, paid tithes in Abraham. Now, don't make that harder than it is. Levi was a great-grandson of Abraham, and when Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek, in that sense, so did Isaac and Jacob and Levi and the others. Symbolically, they all paid tithes. For he was yet in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. If, therefore, perfection was by the Levitical priesthood. If, therefore, perfection was not by the Levitical priesthood. For under it the people received the law, what further need was there that another priest should rise after the order of Melchizedek and not be called after the order of Aaron? Well, the Jews of that day were seeking perfection through the functioning of a Levitical tribe, and perfection was not found there, and it's going to revert back to one who was here long before. For the priesthood being changed, the priesthood was temporary, tithing law was permanent. There is made of necessity a change also of the law. For he of whom these things are spoken, that's Melchizedek, pertains to another tribe of which no man gave attendance at the altar. So here we're really connecting the dots between Melchizedek and Christ. He is of the tribe of Judah. For it is evident that our Lord sprang out of Judah, of which tribe Moses spoke nothing concerning priesthood. And it is yet far more evident, for that after the similitude of Melchizedek there arises another priest, who is made not after the law of carnal commandment, physical commandment, not with a legal genealogy, a legal pedigree, but after the power of an endless life. This being was eternal. He was of the tribe of Judah. For he testifies, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And that comes from Psalm 110, verse 4. For there is truly a disannulling, a setting aside of the commandment, going before for the weakness and unprofitableness thereof. Now the weakness is in the fact that human beings couldn't keep the full intent of the law. Couldn't keep really the letter of the law either. For the law made nothing perfect, but the bringing in of a better hope did, by the which we draw nigh to God. And inasmuch as not without an oath he was made priest, for those priests were made without an oath. That was their right of birth. They happened to be of the line of Aaron, so they were priests. But this, meaning Melchizedek, or Christ, with an oath by him, that said to him, the Lord swear, and will not repent. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. By so much was Jesus made a surety of a better testament. The oath had a lot more clout than a physical lineage. Tithing and the priesthood, these two items were chosen to demonstrate the fact that the Levitical priesthood is about to end and some things have to be modified. Tithing was around before the Old Covenant. Tithing continues after the Old Covenant. It's just administered a bit differently. This transitionary time, it was through the Levitical priests, but also through the New Testament church. But the Levitical system was about to be rendered null and void completely. Back to the booklet on tithing. This is from page 5. Says this change of the law had to do with the change of administration. It meant that the administration of tithing would change with this new priesthood from that of Levi to that of Melchizedek, Christ. Thus, members of the church today continue to tithe, even though the Levitical priesthood has ended, just as Abraham tithed to Melchizedek before the priesthood of Levi was even established. Paul drew on an analogy to demonstrate that as those ministering in the temple were supported by the offerings given at the temple, so the ministering in the church should receive support from the church. He quotes a scripture that we'll look at in just a little bit. So as we wrap this up, let's ask, why do we teach and practice tithing today? And I'll give you just 3 points. Number one is to accomplish the work of God. We are familiar with Matthew 28, verses 19 and 20. And that's where they were told, go to all the world, teach and baptize and teach some more. There is a need, just as there was in the days of Paul. He taught them, you don't muzzle the ox that treads the grain. You know, the laborer is worthy of his hire. Those that preach of the gospel should eat of the gospel. So to preach, to accomplish the work of God. And the work of God in our day and age is a bit different than in their day and age. But we have Beyond Today magazine. We have a core set of booklets. We have a Bible course. We have a Beyond Today television or web program. We have an internet homepage that is just phenomenal. We have churches in international areas. And tithing allows us to be about our Father's business here on the earth. Number two is to provide for local congregational needs. And for this, let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 13 and 14. Do you know that they who minister about holy things live, the marginal note says feed, of the things of the temple? And they who wait at the altar are partakers with the altar. Some of the sacrifices, now like the burnt offering, was wholly, completely burned to God. But you had some, like the person who brought a peace offering. As you follow that story and it plays out, you might have, you know, symbolically, God sitting down and sharing a meal with the one bringing the offering and then the priest with his family, and they sit down and have a meal together. So there was a sharing of what was brought. Verse 14, even so has the Lord ordained that they who preach the gospel should live of the gospel. To provide for local congregational needs, yes, there are salaries, there are pastoral salaries, there are home office salaries, there are those who work with media salaries there are international subsidies, there are local budgets. We turn in a budget. I turn in a budget every January that becomes a part of the overall budget that is balloted upon in May. And then each quarter, as the new fiscal year comes around, send in a request and we will get one-fourth four different times of what was budgeted to make the Huntsville Church happen in a given fiscal year. And then there also are times when there is church assistance to needy and assistance to be able to go and keep a feast. All right, number three is to worship God, because it is an act of worship. It is an act of faith. And for this, let's go to Proverbs 3 and read verses 9 and 10. Proverbs 3, verse 9, honor the Lord with your substance and with the first fruits of all your increase. So shall your barns be filled with plenty, and your presses shall burst out in new wine. Now, from the tithing booklet, again, this is page 5, but it mentions our faith to tithe is founded in the realization that God owns everything, including ourselves, and that we recognize Him as both our Creator and the great giver of all good things. In giving back to God a tenth of our increase, we enter into a special relationship with our Creator and owner. We dedicate ourselves serving Him and financially supporting Christ's commission to preach the gospel and nourish the church. And in return, He promises to bless us Tithing, then, is an intensely personal matter between you and God, a way of demonstrating the depth of your commitment to and relationship with God. Let's close over in Malachi chapter 3, because on the topic of tithing, we really need to look at what Malachi says. Malachi uses blunt terms. If you withhold what is God's, you're stealing from God. Malachi 3, beginning in verse 7. Even from the days of your fathers, you have gone away from my ordinances and have not kept them. Return unto me, and I will return to you, says the Lord of hosts. But you said, see, the people at that day and age always had to come back to God. Wherein shall we return? Verse 8, will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. Yet you say, wherein have we robbed you? The answer, in tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring you all the tithes. So you see, it tells us you can bring in something that is not all the tithes. Into the storehouse, that there may be meat in my house, and prove me now herewith, says the Lord of hosts. If I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. And I will rebuke the devourer for your sakes, and he will not destroy the fruits of your ground. Neither shall your vine cast her fruit before the time in the field, says the Lord of hosts. And all nations shall call you blessed, for you shall be a delightsome land, says the Lord of hosts. So, what kind of price could we put on the fact if we were an agrarian society, if we gained our livelihood from what we could grow in the ground, what would it be worth? If we give God 10% and then the pest, the blight, the invading armies never come through our land, and God pours out a blessing. That's where he says, pour out a blessing, there shall not be room enough to receive it. Anytime we're off track, all we have to do is stop where we are, turn in the way that God wants us to go, and start putting one foot in front of the other and start going in that direction. Church isn't in the punishment business. God isn't in the punishment business. He wants us to learn to put Him first. God rejoices in our widow's mites and uses them, multiplies them to serve His purpose. In the Church of God, I think we have a fantastic number of people who are very, very faithful in what they have given, what they are giving. They put God first. So on behalf of the church, I'd just like to say thank you for your continued faithful support of the work of God here on the earth.